the National Museum of the American Indian in Washington, D.C. It reopened last month with more safety measures amid COVID. We're spending the hour with the head of this Smithsonian Museum here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is a moment, right? We've seen Confederate monuments come down. Some statues offensive to Native Americans as well. This summer, the NFL franchise in Washington, D.C. decided to drop its team name, which Native Americans have long criticized for being racially offensive. And then Standing Rock, the years-long bitter fight to stop a pipeline from disturbing sacred land and polluting water. The Standing Rock and Cheyenne River Sioux tribes renewed their calls last month for a federal court to shut down the Dakota Access Pipeline. Are you Indigenous? How do you feel about the appropriation of your culture by white Americans? We're at 800-642-1234 for conversation. Kevin Gover is director of the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of the American Indian. He is a citizen of the Pawnee Tribe of Oklahoma. Kevin, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
So there's an exhibit right now that highlights all of the ways that Native American culture has been part of the country's cultural identity from the beginning. Tell us what icons and images stand out to you from this exhibit at your museum.
Well, the exhibition is called Americans, and we say that a little tongue-in-cheek. You know, when the term Americans first emerged in the English language, it was actually a reference to the indigenous people of the Americas. And, of course, over time that definition has changed, or the usage of the word has changed. But we're interested in this this strange role that the indigenous people of the United States have always played in American identity, sort of beginning with, for example, the Boston Tea Party, where the colonists dressed as Indians, not so much to disguise themselves as to assert an identity as Americans. And when we see all of these clubs that gentlemen's clubs, not of the type we have now, but truly the gentlemen of a city would form a club. And it usually had some kind of Indian theming to it. And so there, these clubs, like the Improved Order of Red Men, were all over the country in all of the major cities. The Tammany Society in New York was such a club. And so there does seem to be this strange pull of Native American identity that Americans feel. These clubs used to dress up, in quotes, like Indians, and they would give each other, in quotes, Indian names and sing Indian songs and do Indian things. And so, you know, that's kind of weird when you think about it. So as we look across the culture, we see all of these different images from mascots for sports teams to you know, the strange role that Indians have played in the movies since the very beginning of the movies, to their placement on products. But probably my favorite item in the exhibition is an actual cruise missile, a Tomahawk missile. And so where we're bringing out that the United States Armed Forces have often used Native imagery and Native names for their regiments, for their weapon systems. We all know about the Apache helicopter and such. So those are the things that intrigue us about this phenomenon.
It feels like this appropriation permeates all aspects of our society.
Well, it really does. I mean, it's first of all, Indians are attached to just this really strange and insane combination of different products, most of which Indians had not a lot to do with developing. So we're all familiar with the Land of Lakes logo that was recently retired. And, of course, Indians didn't have dairy products. We see it on citrus cartons. We see it on baking powder. We see it pretty much throughout the culture.
We're talking, if you're just joining us, talking with Kevin Gover, who is a citizen of the Pawnee Nation of Oklahoma, director of the National Museum of the American Indian. We're talking about Native identity and this moment we're at of reckoning and understanding cultural identity. Join in with your observations, your questions, 800-642-1234. Kevin, if you will, take us back to your childhood growing up in the Pawnee Nation. How did you think about these images of Native Americans that were all around you?
Well, I grew up in Lawton, Oklahoma, which is in southwest Oklahoma. And, of course, I had a lot of relatives around. I knew we were Indians. Wasn't entirely clear, of course, on just what that meant, but, you know, that's sort of who I was. And you would see these images show up, especially on television. I was really a television kid. And you would see all sorts of things. Sometimes the Indians were good guys, sometimes they were bad guys. But they were almost always illiterate, not particularly smart, usually quite brave, although they could also be very brutal. And it was puzzling to me because they weren't like the Indians I knew at all. And then when you add to it something like a football mascot, the Washington team used to play the Dallas Cowboys regularly down in Dallas, and that was the only game we'd get on our televisions for that weekend. And it was confusing because I couldn't figure out, well, should I be rooting for this team that, you know, has a native spear on the side of its helmet, or should I be rooting for the Cowboys, who we all know spent a lot of time killing Indians? That too, by the way, is a myth. And so, you know, it was disconcerting to a kid, and, you know, kids don't have the resources to sort of understand what culture is and how it operates. And
it likely wasn't playing out in your educational system where you're going to school. You probably weren't getting any more context.
That's for sure. No, we like most schools at the time, you know, I was taught the little ditty about how in 1492 Columbus sailed the ocean blue. And I can say with confidence that in my years of schooling in public schools, I never learned a thing that really made me proud of my ancestors.
Mm. Wow. How did you talk with your family members about this? What did they say to you?
Well, you know, they taught me, you know, my parents were first of all, they were a mixed race couple. My mother was white, my father was Indian. And so I didn't really appreciate the kinds of challenges that they were facing at that time and place and being who they are. But they were also civil rights activists. And so I learned early on, you know, that we weren't to judge people by the color of their skin, by their cultural background. And happily, I was exposed to people of all kinds, even as a child, and to see and listen to and learn to admire, because they were pretty special, doctors and lawyers and other professionals. But there was this thing out there all the time that the way the culture perceived Indians and portrayed Indians bore no relationship to my reality as a Native American kid.
We have the director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian. Kevin Gover is here with us. Are you a member of one of Wisconsin's First Nation communities? How do you feel about Native American mascots, statues, and the history lessons about Native culture in the textbooks? Have you been to the National Museum of the American Indian in Washington or maybe in New York City? Tell us about your experience. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Kevin Gover right here on the Ideas Network. You're with us as we have a conversation about Native American rights and identity and this crossroads and cultural reckoning. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Wisconsin Indian Education Association had a mascot and logo task force, and last summer, dozens of school districts still appropriated a race-based sports team identity. Do you think Native American mascots are offensive? When the Washington NFL team retired its name, did you think that would cause more teams to follow suit? Join in, 800-642-1234. We have Kevin Gover with us, the director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian. He's our guide. Let's take a call now. Rich is joining us from Rhinelander. Hi, Rich. You're on with Kevin Gover.
Thank you. I'm not an indigenous person, as a matter of fact. Our father in this family was born in Europe and became a naturalized citizen. But in a conversation recently, a friend said to me, you do know that Mount Rushmore is built on Indian lands, don't you? And I didn't. And I'm questioning, is that true? It made me really sad because when our family came to this country, we, like many Europeans, immediately began acquiring property, and we think of the property as our own. And I can't think of a greater insult to a person or a group of people than going on land that they own and then setting up a monument to their subjugation. I'm asking the director, is this true?
Rich, thank you. Kevin.
Yeah, it's essentially true. You know, let's face it, this is a practice of conquerors throughout human history. But the Black Hills, where Mount Rushmore is located, were sacred not just to the Lakota people, but to other tribes in the plains. But in a treaty in 1868, the Black Hills were promised to the Great Sioux Nation, and were a part of the Great Sioux Nation, but only for a few years. And about a few years after that, none other than General Custer led an expedition into the Black Hills to explore rumors of gold in the Black Hills. And sure enough, there was gold in the Black Hills. The prospectors began moving in illegally because this is still part of the Great Sioux Nation. And the resulting conflict is the one in which Custer was defeated. But it was not long after that the last of the Sioux were rounded up and put on the reservation, and then basically forced to sign a fraudulent agreement that took the Black Hills from them. And we know that it was fraudulent and illegal because the Supreme Court said so. But only 100 years later, and the compensation that was offered to the tribes was not the return of their land, but rather the payment of cash, which the tribes have rejected. So it is true that that Mount Rushmore is built in lands that the Sioux still regard as sacred, even though under the law it no longer belongs to them. Certainly morally it should, and spiritually it does.
Rich, thank you for that question. Kevin Gover is here, director of Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian and member of the Pawnee Tribe of Oklahoma. We're looking at First Nation communities, past, present, and future with your questions as well. Let's bring in Daryl now in Couderay. Hi, Daryl.
Hello. Thank you for the program.
Sure.
I'm an enrolled member of the Lakuteray Band of the Ojibwe here in Wisconsin. And in May of this year, speaking of monuments, the Ark of Dreams was installed in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and it crosses it. It arches over the Great Sioux River. Now, in 2016, I collaborated with the artist laureate for the state of South Dakota at that time, and I created the design, new design, the sixth and final design, and I used four words and an acronym to describe it to the artist. And the words were three aerials wrapped in DNA. Now, I was supposed to have a job working on that project, 18-month project, but I got no job and I got no recognition. What would you suggest, sir?
Oh, my. I hope you're not asking me for legal advice because I'm no longer a lawyer. The only thing I can advise is that you continue to tell your story to as many people as you can and try to have your role in the creation of this acknowledged.
Kevin, you've been talking a lot about monuments, thinking about monuments, especially the depiction of Native Americans. You testified on monuments earlier this summer. How should we view these monuments that represent and show images of Native Americans?
Well, I suggest that we should look at most of them with a skeptical eye. Because in general, the monuments that we see out there, the monuments in most American public places, were not created by Indians and reflect in no way Native sensibilities and their own sense of who they are. And so what we see instead are what I call the imaginary Indians. These are the Indians that exist primarily in the minds of non-Indians who have been taught by the popular culture and by the formal education system, a very badly flawed version of not just Native American history, but American history. And certainly have, if you rely on those sources, you will come away with virtually no understanding of what contemporary Native Americans are and how they see themselves. So, you know, again, conquerors build monuments not to the defeated, but to themselves. And so any depiction you're likely to see of Native people in these kinds of spaces are very unlikely to genuinely reflect any Native American history or culture.
Should they come down?
You know, two things. One, I'm always against vandalism. I don't want to see these things be torn down, you know, by an unruly mob. On the other hand, I think that after a thorough discussion, after a candid discussion of what the actual history has been relating to this monument, who built it, who paid for it, who designed it, what was its purpose, when was it built? All of those things, as in the case of the Confederate memorials, really should inform the decision-making of the local people. In most cases, I think they should come down.
Let's bring in Kathy now, who's joining us from Lac des Flambeaux. Hi, Kathy.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I live in Lac des Flambeaux, but I am of the Pembina Band of the Turtle Mountain Chippewa out of North Dakota, and then I'm a first-generation descendant. My father's side for Standing Rock Sioux from Cannonball, North Dakota. LaDonna Bravebill Allard and her husband Miles Allard, who was a Turtle Mountain Chippewa, by the way, had the Protectors Camp over at Dakota Access Pipeline. And when they went in and tried to shut them down, they lied to them, and they told them that they were needed to go over to the highway and that they're checking the area. And they went in and bulldozed the entire area down. And that area was supposed to be used for an educational camp post the protection camp. And so that devastated LaDonna, her family property, and they have family burials and things there. So I see the current administration just overlooking all sorts of sacred sites and things that should be protected. That camp is within a area of a declared historical site, which was a conical teepee mound, and there shouldn't have been any of that going on there.
Kathy, let's pause there for Kevin and your view of sacred sites and Standing Rock.
Well, certainly American law simply does not do what it could and should for the protection of sacred Native American sites. And they do so for no better reason than they're inconvenient, because quite often there's a proposal to run a pipeline or run a highway or run, you know, build something in some place that Native Americans regard as sacred. And there are examples literally all over the country of this kind of thing happening. The same with even archaeological sites where ancestors are buried, are rather routinely disturbed and even disposed of. And on occasion, the developers do everything that they can to avoid anyone knowing that they've disturbed a grave site because it's against the law. And so the caller is describing is common and happens all over the country. I've little doubt that that's what happened in the case of the Dakota Access Pipeline.
Kevin Gover heads up the Smithsonian National Museum of the American Indian. What would you like to say about Native life and the culture you've passed down to your children? Has the sacred singing, drumming, and dancing of a powwow been silenced due to the pandemic? How do you stay together and stay safe? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Just a heads up on our programming plans here. Vice President Mike Pence and U.S. Senator Kamala Harris will meet for the vice presidential candidate debate. That's tonight at 8. We will bring you live NPR coverage of the debate on Wisconsin Public Radio and at WPR.org. Right now, tribal leaders and Native American health groups have asked Congress for additional relief as First Nations face a dire situation from the COVID pandemic. The head of the National Council of Urban Indian Health testified before Congress late last month saying the state of affairs in Indian country remains dire. Are you a member of a tribal community? How are you doing amid the pandemic? Join in the conversation. We have the director of the National Museum of the American Indian, Kevin Gover, for the hour. Kevin, how would you assess how Native Americans are doing amid the pandemic, how tribal communities are faring?
It really varies from place to place. Many of the tribes have done well, especially considering their access to health care is very limited in many circumstances. Others, though, have seen very severe outbreaks. The Navajos, the Apaches in Arizona, the Choctaws in Mississippi, and other places. And with the result that the death rates have been quite dire in those communities, so it's really a mixed bag, just as it is for the rest of the country.
Let's bring in Phil now, who's joining us from Madison with thoughts. Hi, Phil.
Yes, I'm really conflicted over this whole issue of Indian memorabilia and what have you, because. First of all, being a Cherokee, we're very proud of the fact that us that invented the first Native written language for a Native tribe. I am also conflicted over the fact that, yes, we were the Europeans that came over here were much more apparently technically able to suppress the population that was here, which I don't want to say was indigenous because it came over from Russia. Or that area of the world a lot earlier, I'll grant you that, but they were not initially native to this continent. And there are a lot of things that were going on in this country. I've done a lot of research on Indian heritage across the United States. For instance, a lot of the Plain tribes were not as brutal as the Blackfeet up in the northern part of the western United States, and the Comanche, of course, who the Pawnees helped the Pony soldiers destroy, they were brutal beyond belief.
Well, Phil, I want you to circle back to how you do feel conflicted about mascots. What can you say more there for Kevin?
Yes, okay, I feel that they remind us. They're a constant reminder that we're here. Maybe not the best way to remember us, but at least nobody else is doing very much to remember that we're here. My grandmother, for instance, should be on the rolls of the Cherokee Nation, but they closed those rolls in 1904, and she was a bit illiterate. although a medicine woman and delivered many, many babies in southern Illinois and knew all the herbs and all the things. But they would not let her enroll after 1904, even though she was full-blooded Cherokee.
Well, Phil, I'm going to have Kevin jump in here about, you know, feeling conflicted and that these mascots are a reminder, as Phil says, that we're here.
Yeah, well, you're not the only one that feels that way. You know, and basically the argument is better to be remembered poorly than not to be remembered at all. But I don't accept those as the only possibilities. And the one thing we can be certain of is that Indians are much more visible now in the 21st century than they were in the early 20th century when most of these mascots emerged. And it was a time when Native people were badly suppressed. They were confined to reservations. There were only 250,000 Natives at the beginning of the 20th century, that down from, of course, the several million that had been here prior to contact. And the government was suppressing their religion, suppressing their languages, taking their kids and sending them to boarding schools. And the very purpose of all of this was to see that there would be no more people who were identifiably Native Americans. That was literally the objective: kill the Indian, save the man. And so it was then that these mascots emerged, at the time when Indians were at their very weakest in their history, that people decided, well, they're going to disappear, so it's okay for us now to pretend to be them. And it wasn't okay, and it's never been okay. And of the many, many ways that the country and different communities might acknowledge their Native American past, and every community in the United States has a Native American past, of the many choices they might have made, making us their sports mascot is among the worst possibilities. If for no other reason than they make virtually no effort to be accurate in their depiction of the Native people in their regions or in their communities. But it also comes, you know, to be seen only in those kinds of ways, in ways that are caricatures and stereotypes, comes at the expense of the real Native people who still exist, who still have needs and still have aspirations, are still Americans. And so the mascots really do nothing to advance the cause of Native American people.
Along the lines of being seen, the federal government currently recognizes 574 tribal entities. Is there an estimate, Kevin, for the total number of tribes in our country?
Oh, yes, there are, but only estimates. So there are another 100 and some that are acknowledged by the states in which they reside, but are not acknowledged by the United States. And many of these are attempting to gain federal recognition. It's hard to say how many of them will succeed. The process is torturous, and most tribes are not successful in gaining federal recognition at this point.
We're talking with Kevin Gover, who is director of the Smithsonian Museum of the American Indian and a member of the Pawnee tribe. We're looking at Native American rights, culture, and identity with your questions and your comments. Let's bring in Aaron now, who is joining us from Oshkosh this morning. Hi, Aaron.
Yes, hello and greetings, everyone. Thank you for, one, having this as a topic on the radio today, and two, taking my call.
Absolutely.
I would just like to begin by stating I am not Native. However, I am a lifelong proponent of Indigenous sovereignty and independence. And basically, I called in to say that we as a people need to finally concretize the long-running dialogue regarding Native reparations, and we need to do it now. We will never be able to undo the institutional racism that taints our national socio-political health, let alone do anything about establishing a new socio-political paradigm where non-male Caucasian lives can actually effectively matter. We must exercise the innate racism that has polluted our country and government since its inception or continued to suffer the consequences. It is 2020. There will be nothing done until we start at the beginning of unraveling this painted blanket in which we're tucking all these neo-Nazi white.
Yeah, and Aaron, I want Kevin here to respond to your to what you're saying here. We can't move forward, Kevin, you know, Aaron is saying here, until we address what has happened in the past.
Well, I certainly agree with that. So many of the problems that we're finding in our society, everything from, of course, the overt racism and the rise of white supremacist groups, to more basic economic issues about wealth and property and access to health care and primary social services and education, can find their roots where we are failing, can find their roots in a racist past that this country has. And, you know, I feel very strongly we need not to be afraid of acknowledging those things. And I say to people all the time, you know, when I talk about what the United States has done that was so unnecessary and so cruel to Native America, I'm not saying you did it. But at the same time, I think we have to acknowledge that because of these misdeeds of the past, that has resulted in many of the inequities that we see today. And if we can focus on solving those inequities, I think that's necessary, not just to our progress as a nation, but ultimately to our survival as a nation.
How do we come to the table, though? How do we talk about these inequities and actually get things done?
By talking. I mean, that's, you know, I don't know another way to do it.
Yeah.
I think that we sit in a room together and we discuss these things and try to acknowledge one another's truths and understandings and see where the common ground is. And I'll give you a great example. I don't, you know, except for the most venal of us, no one wants to see police killing black people. And yet it's happening all the time. And now we understand finally that this is a huge problem. And there are things that can be done about it. And it doesn't involve, you know, throwing the police in jail or shutting down police forces. Quite the contrary. There are common sense things that we can talk about to stop or at least reduce dramatically the incidences of this kind of killing. So we've got to talk to each other. We've just got to.
Kevin Gover directs the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of the American Indian, a member of the Pawnee Tribe of Oklahoma. What does tribal sovereignty mean to you, and why is it paramount for Native communities? What protections for Native people have seemed to wane over the years? Where do you see hope right now? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Kevin Gover here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Kevin Gover. Next month, the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian will open the exhibit called Why We Serve that tells the history of more than 250 years of Native American participation in the military. Kevin Gover has led the National Museum of the American Indian for more than a decade. Let's take another call now. Ken is joining us from Holcomb this morning. Hi, Ken.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to hear your guest's comments on what seems to me a subtle kind of institutional racism. When I was a student at Madison at the university, my family and I would go up to Devil's Lake. When I lived in Menominee, we would often visit a beautiful geological site called the Devil's Punch Bowl and also have hiked around the Devil's Tower. And I always wondered why it's Devil's this and Devil's that. And I just wondered if it wasn't early European settlers setting aside places of, Native, in European viewpoint, pagan worship, spiritual sites as being different from places where Christians might worship, and in a way of saying that if they were holy to the Native Americans, they had something to do with the devil. I wondered if your guests would comment on that.
Yeah, Ken, thank you. Kevin.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought, and one that I've never spent much time with. I think we can be certain that these places were not referred to that way by the Native people who were indigenous to these areas. And but yeah, that makes as much sense as anything I've ever heard about why they would choose to name them for the devil, which of course is not really a concept in most Native American spirituality.
Ken, thank you. Let's bring in Kathleen now from Steuben. Hi, Kathleen.
Hello. I would like to ask your guest here about what possible protections or restoration for the effigy mounds, which are grave mounds, very prominent here in southwest Wisconsin, and that how to effectively protect them, what restoration would be appropriate, how could people, and that they obviously, from my readings anyway, that the effigy mounds are monumental spiritual monuments to the spirits of the earth and the ancestors, and that they should have religious protection under the First Amendment.
Kathleen, thanks. Kevin, how do we protect these mounds?
Well, I think any such places should certainly be protected by the laws, if not by the federal preservation laws, then hopefully by state and local preservation laws, because you know they are such a deep part of the history of the region. And all of this, by the way, should be conducted in consultation with the tribal governments in Wisconsin, you know, who see it as their responsibility to steward these places. So I hope that's what will happen. I have to admit, I don't know anything about the preservation laws in Wisconsin, but I certainly hope that something can be done to protect sites like that.
Kevin, how does your museum collaborate with tribes? How do you work with tribes around the country and then bring your exhibits to fruition?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you. So, you know, in the past, and really not that long ago, well within most of our lifetimes, the way museums did their work around Native American material was to have some guy, usually not an Indian, go to school and get an advanced degree studying anthropology or archaeology or something like that. And then they would go out and look at this material and say, ah, here's what this is, and here's how they used it, and here's what they were thinking while they used it, and here's what we know about these people. And that, you know, that seems so silly now in just the last 30 years since the National Museum of the American Indian was established, museum practice has completely changed. And no self-respecting museum working with Native American material in this day and age would do so without working with the tribal communities whose stories are being told or are implicated by the material that's being shown. So depending on the subject and the particular themes that we're pursuing, we'll spend a great deal of time with the communities where the material originates. We have something like 900,000 items in our collections. And for a great many of them, we don't know nearly all that we should about them. And the best source of information about what they are and what their significance is with the tribal communities where they originated. So we see it as museum malpractice not to confer with the community when we decide that we're going to display that material.
Do you ever give those Native artifacts, those holdings, back to the tribal community?
Quite often we do, in two forms. One is if it's a sacred object or if it involves human remains or material that was taken from a grave upon the request of either a descendant of the individual or the tribe that is involved, then we're required by law to return those to the community. And so we've returned several thousand items to tribes all across the United States and even in some cases in other countries. The other way we do it, though, and this is with material that's not necessarily sacred, is that there's a wonderful growing number of tribal museums all across the country. And we like working with those tribal museums in order to send back the things that we have in our collection that are from those places. And so we have major loans out in about half a dozen different tribal museums across the country, and we would like to expand that number.
How do they feel about receiving those artifacts back?
Well, it's enormously rewarding for us. And, you know, when we see their response to seeing something made by perhaps an ancestor that they know, it is really incredibly emotional and powerful. And it's sort of like those are the moments that make it all worthwhile, having to put in all the work to preserve these things. So, and in some cases, tribes have actually reclaimed and begun to practice again some elements of their cultures or religions that had gone away because they didn't have the right material to do it. And it turned out that it was in our collections. And so it's just it's a great thing. And Congress did a really good thing when they made that rule 30 years ago.
I want to circle back to education here for a moment where we started, and you know, as we were talking about your schooling, but looking at schooling today and what our country, how our country goes about teaching history, teaching Native American history, what are you seeing out there?
That it's getting better, but much too slowly. I think most states and most school districts and most teachers realize that that they're not doing it right, that they don't have the information that they need in order to properly teach American history, and especially those elements that involve Native Americans. So, but there are many organizations, including our own, the National Museum of the American Indian, who are trying to fill that gap and are working with teachers and with tribal communities to try to create material that tells a true story about the Native history of these places. So there's a lot of goodwill out there, but there is a lot of work to do.
And finally, in our last few moments, just some practical question here. How has it been since your museum reopened amid the pandemic?
You know, the Smithsonian has been very careful about reopening because we don't want to be a place where people come to, you know, enjoy culture or history or science and end up going home sick with the virus. So we have very firm rules. We limit the number of people who can come. They must wear masks. We have hand sanitizer at many locations in each of our museums as we open. And the staff is trained to both enforce these rules and yet find a way to engage with the visitors. We have lots of plexiglass around the museums. So so far so good. You know, none of our staff, the museums began to reopen as early as July. We continue to open more museums. And so we're encouraged so far. But it's not the same, and it won't be the same until the pandemic is over.
Kevin, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
Kevin Gover is director of the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of the American Indian. He is a citizen of the Pawnee Tribe of Oklahoma. Just ahead, it's 1A. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.